Hi everyone, and welcome to the Ravencast. My name is Adam Erickson, and I'm really excited for this episode with Preston Shipp. Preston is a former prosecutor who had this kind of conversion experience where he saw that he was caught up in an unjust system, and so he's now become an advocate for criminal justice reform. And his story is compelling. It's great. It jives really well with mimetic theory, as you will soon find out. But before you watch, I wanted to let you know that we had a couple of technical difficulties. For the first 15 minutes, our faces are frozen, but after that, they're not. They're unfrozen. So there's that. And then the audio went bad a couple of times, but it's very brief. It's just some like minor feedback that lasts 3 to 5 seconds. So just get through it, and you will hear this amazing story. So thank you for watching, and I'd love to hear your feedback. Take care. Bye-bye. Hi, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the Ravencast. My name is Adam Erickson, and I'm here with Preston Shipp. Hi, Preston. How are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing great. I am so excited to have you on the show. We met at Theology in Peace a couple of weeks ago, and you just blew me away with your story. And it's, you know, at the Raven Foundation, we talk a lot about mimetic theory. We're guided by the theory, and you are just everything that's good about mimetic theory. And I was just like, I gotta have Preston on the show because your story is just—it's just phenomenal. So thank you for being here.
Well, thank you. It's an honor, and I'm glad to see you again. And I see some familiar names over there. So thank you for having me on.
Yeah, we've got a live audience, and we've got quite a few people. Lindsay and Paul and Russ and Suella and Suzanne and Tom. And we'll probably get a few others as we go along. So if any of you have questions, please feel free to make comments, type them in the chat room over there on the left-hand side, and I'll get you in. So yeah, thanks for being here. Preston is a former prosecutor and now criminal justice reform advocate. And as I said, Preston's story is just amazing, and excited to have you on. And basically, I'm tempted, Preston, to just shut up for the next hour and let you talk because your story is so compelling and great. But I want to give people kind of a little bit of an intro into why I think you're so compelling for mimetic theory. Just very briefly, mimetic theory says that we are so often blinded to our scapegoats. And Preston, you had this experience where your eyes were just opened in a very radical way. And you also have a video on YouTube called Redemption of a Prosecutor. And I watched that after I was listening to your conversation. And in there, mimetic theory says that we are our relationships. So it kind of challenges the idea of autonomy. And in your video, you say that you always assume that these people that you were prosecuting were autonomous individuals acting with free will. And this experience really kind of challenged that view. And so that's another reason why I wanted you on. And you also said that your salvation somehow is bound up with these people in prison. And I just want to hear your story about becoming a prosecutor and having this kind of radical conversion experience along the way.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's certainly not anything that I chose for myself, and it didn't come about from, reading mimetic theory, or anything like that. I kind of had blinders on for the time that I was in college and law school and the first part of my career. I was convinced that what I needed to do was to plug into the criminal justice system as a prosecutor, and that I was vindicating society, and that I was, on the side of victims, and that I was the white hat, wearing the white hat, and that the people that I was arguing against, that I was prosecuting, these were terrible people who had done terrible things, and they deserved to be put in prison, that that's really the only thing that we can do when somebody breaks the law is punish them. And that was very much in line with my theology, I think, at the time. And so I went to law school and I became a prosecutor, and I was writing briefs and arguing cases, every day for years, and never really experienced any tension or angst over what I did. I believed in the system. I believed that, defendants had constitutional rights to protect them, but that at the end of the day, when they were found guilty and when they were sentenced to a prison term, that's exactly what needed to happen, because they had made these choices. You mentioned autonomy, and the law kind of assumes that we are able to decide for ourselves, are we going to break the law or not? And if we decide to break the law, then there are consequences for that. And so that's what I did for years and years until I started getting involved in prison education work. And that's what kind of started to change my mind and my heart.
Tell me about that prison experience. How did you get into it?
Well, my dad actually always was involved in prison ministry through his church. So I grew up with my dad going to prison. In fact, in high school, I sang in my high school chorus, and we would go around to different area churches singing and stuff. And a lot of times parents were there in the crowd, we would go through when we would be at our home congregation, we would say whether or not, our parents went to that church. And a lot of times on Sunday nights when we were doing that, my dad was off doing worship services at the prison, And so I would introduce my mom and I'd say, and my dad's in prison tonight, So he was an example to me. I always believed from his example that going to people who were in prison and, doing worship services with them, but that was very much a part of what Christians ought to be doing. But there was a disconnect, it's not that they didn't need to be in prison. We sure didn't need to be advocating for criminal justice reform. We were just concerned about their salvation, and so we would go out there. So I was always aware of prison work and that it needed to be done and that not a lot of people are doing it. But what really started to kind of change my paradigm, I guess, was when an old college professor of mine invited me to teach the inaugural class in a college prison program that he was going to start offering. And so I started going out to the prison every week to teach law classes to people who were locked up.
What was your relationship like with your college professor before this? Was he like a mentor to you?
Yeah, he was. He was a history professor, and I was a history major, and he was my advisor. His name was Richard Good, and he was one of those college professors, you hear about, or they make movies about, that he really he brought history to life. I had other history professors who just wanted you to memorize events and dates, and it was very dry, and it didn't really require anything of you other than memorization. But when Richard Good would teach, he would always have some theme that we were exploring. And you might never memorize an event or a date, but you would talk about trends. So one semester, the big theme that we talked about was, who were the first Americans? And what does it mean to say that you're an American? Who was the first group of people that legitimately could claim to be American? And then I had another class where we were studying mostly 20th century American history, and his theme was, what is the American dream? And he presented all these different groups of people, from industrialists to the Amish people and their version of the American dream. And so he was always very challenging. And I think that when he invited me to come out to the prison to teach, it was really kind of another challenge that he was kind of issuing to me, because he knew at the time that I was a prosecutor. And I think that he thought that he would kind of pluck me up out of my prosecutorial role and drop me in the middle of a group of inmates. And, it's like tossing a hand grenade, just kind of see what's going to happen. I don't think he could have anticipated exactly how it all turned out, you know, but I definitely think that he was pushing on me a little bit.
Yeah. And you had enough of a relationship with him beforehand that you would trust him in this process of doing prison ministry, education.
Sure, and I always valued education. And so when he pitched it to me, you know, he said he didn't want to just take the college classes out to the prison, but he wanted to have traditional college kids come along with us so that I would be the instructor and I would have 15 inmates in my class, but I would also have 15 traditional college students. And so our discussion of the criminal justice process, it was very dynamic because you've got 15 people who, by virtue of the process, are now incarcerated, and then the other half of the class doesn't know a thing about the process because they're just, you know, bright-eyed 20-year-old college undergrads. And so, yeah, I mean, I had to trust, you know, that what he was doing made a lot of sense where better to study about criminal process than out of the prison? I mean, I thought it was so exciting.
Yeah. What was that like for those two groups to come together?
I think there was a lot of fear and apprehension in both camps because, the college kids, they'd never been to a prison before. They had never been shaken down and searched. And, you know, they see all that fencing and razor wire and the steel doors. And that's kind of scary your first time. But then you had the inmates, many of whom are, you know, were middle-aged, some of them were in their 50s, 60s, and maybe they hadn't been to college in 30 years, or maybe they'd never been to college. Some of these people, they were the first person in their family to ever take a college class, and they're going in there with 15 essentially professional students who do this all day, every day, and they were concerned that they would fail, that they would not be able to do the work, that the test would roll around and that they would not be able to master the material. They were also afraid that the traditional Lipscomb kids were going to be judgmental because all they have known, is from free society, forever how long they've been locked up, is judgment and condemnation. And I think that they thought, is this just going to be one more opportunity to have stones thrown at us? It took a lot of guts for them to sign up for that class because they, you know, have to come in there in their prison outfit, and it's very clear. We had a very clear divide, who's an insider and who's an outsider. And so they had to overcome a lot of fear themselves, I think.
How did the Lipscomb students respond to them? Were they judgmental at first?
I never got the feeling that there was any judgment. I think that initially they had to kind of overcome some of the sensationalism that surrounds crime in prisons. When you meet somebody and they seem nice, and then you find out that they, you know, have been convicted of murder, that tends to upend, you know, your expectations and your prejudices a little bit. But I don't think that they were ever judgmental. I think that any prejudice that they had was pretty well blown apart that first night when they got out there and they found out how kind all these women were, you know, that these women were really kind of welcoming us into it's their home, I guess. It's a damn sad home, but it's where they live, and they welcomed these Lipscomb kids out there and showed them hospitality. And I think that it probably disturbed any prejudice that these Lipscomb kids had. By the end of the semester, everybody was hugging. You know, when the class was over, everybody hugged and exchanged mailing addresses so that they could stay in touch, because over the course of those 16 weeks, they had discovered that they were all pretty much the same. With you know, they watched the same TV shows, you know, and they listened to the same songs, and they traded books, and they got to see that despite all the differences, they're fundamentally the same.
Yeah, that's a powerful message. It also reminds me of what you said frequently during your talk at Theology and Peace, that the criminal justice system, and you found yourself in this pattern too, defining people by the worst thing that they did. And you kept saying people are not the worst thing that they did. And that's part of your conversion experience. How did you get to that point where you realized that?
Well, that was where I was starting from, and I think that's where any prosecutor would be starting from, because you don't know that defendant. The system is set up, you hear it talked about as an adversarial system. They're kept separate. They have their own attorney, and you're not allowed to talk to them. And so all that you really know about them is this crime that they committed. There's not an opportunity for you to find out a whole lot more about them. And certainly for me, because I was handling almost exclusively appeals, oftentimes I didn't even lay eyes on the defendant. I just received a record from the court, and I read the record of what happened at the trial, and I read the defendant's brief, and then I typed up my own brief and made my argument, and then went on to the next case. And so all that I knew about the person was this awful thing that they had done. They were their crime, as far as I was concerned. The names were interchangeable, This case is a first degree murder case, that case is a aggravated robbery case, and I have to make my argument in each one of those cases. And when all that you know about a person is the worst thing that they've ever done, then that lends itself so easily to dehumanizing that person, to forgetting that they are a complicated individual like all of us are, that they have great potential for good and for bad, that they've been through stuff, that there was a context, that crime does not happen in a vacuum. It just lends itself well to, I guess, scapegoating, to use a buzzword. It absolutely lends itself to that. It's hard not to give in to that when all the information that you have is very, it's limited in time and in scope, and it's all negative.
Suella Gerber has a comment. Hi, Suella. She says, "I love this description of finding their sameness, and I'm still struck by the fact that you grew up visiting prisoners, but those weren't occasions for human beings meeting other human beings." And I think you spoke about this a bit at the conference, where there's a prison ministry is often, and I don't know if this was what your dad was doing or not, but there's often a power dynamic between the person visiting and the prisoner. Can you talk about that a little bit? Where it is kind of less than human?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that most people, because there's not many people who are visiting prisoners, church folks or otherwise. And so I think most of them, have great intentions. When you go in there with the idea that I have something to impart to all these poor individuals, that I am good, and I know that I'm good because I'm not wearing a prison uniform. And I'm going in there to preach to all of these poor, wayward, prodigal souls. That's not community, at all. I mean, that's a very patriarchal and at times patronizing posture to go in there with. And so most of the time in traditional prison ministry, whoever the outsider is, they're the ones who are going to be leading the songs and leading the prayers and reading the scriptures and giving the lesson, and all the leadership is this outsider who really is not probably very well acquainted with the needs of that particular faith community. And that's what it is. It's a church. You're going into their church. It's kind of a one-way street. And I've had guys tell me, guys and girls tell me, maybe they've been a Christian for 15 years, but the only message they hear from religious volunteers is, you need to get saved. You need to get saved. You need to repent. It's almost like this assumption that you can't have, a lifelong Christian who's serving a prison sentence. And so when I went in there, and as part of the education program, it was a much more dialogue driven exchange. I wasn't going in there to deliver a sermon or lead a prayer. I was going in there to foster a conversation about the criminal justice process. And so we put all our chairs in a circle so that we could all see each other and hear each other. And I would lead the discussion. I would throw out questions, but then everybody had the opportunity to contribute. And that's where you start to hear their stories and hear how much they have to offer. And I had never encountered anything like that in traditional prison ministry. So, yeah, I feel like if you can create that space where there's not so much of a, there's going to be a power imbalance, you know, and that's just, that's the nature of the beast. But if you can go in there and respect, you know, particularly that when Jesus said you go to the prison and you encounter Jesus there, not that you take him in with you, but that's where you meet Jesus, well, that would change the posture with which you go in there. I'm not going in there to teach as much as I am to learn. I'm assuming that if that's the Lord in there, that I probably need to be quiet and listen to what he might have to say.
That's great. And it leads me to your comment that your salvation is caught up in your relationship with them. What is salvation for you in this context? And what is salvation for them in this context?
I would say that salvation for me has, I've come to identify it closely with the ministry of reconciliation that Paul writes about in 2 Corinthians chapter 5. You know, where, you know, it's not, it's salvation is not just a matter of what's going to happen to me after I die, but that Paul talks about, you know, that in Christ we have been given, you know, this ministry of reconciliation, that God was reconciling the world to himself through Jesus, and that we are now ministers of that ministry of reconciliation. And so I would say, you know, you talk about how much we need reconciliation. There's so many different areas that we need reconciliation, but we've got 2.3 million people in this country locked away from us that the system has said, these people can't be reconciled. You know, they need to be separated and isolated. And so for me, experiencing salvation is about being reconciled, seeing just how alike we are, you know, despite our different circumstances and all the advantages that I was born into. It's not like I arrived here on my own, you know, and had I been in their situation, you know, I'm not any more or less capable than anybody else, you know. And so recognizing those things about myself, and then hopefully on their part, having people come in and extend to them, you know, acceptance and them being able to trust in that relationship, that they're accepted, that they're loved, that you know, we think more of them than their, you know, prisoner ID number. I hope that they experience some of that reconciliation as well.
Yeah, and you've kind of found that reconciliation with one of your students. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so the I guess Centoya Brown was a student the second time that I taught in the program, and she kind of put a fine point on a lot of this for me. By the time I had her in class, she had already been in prison for maybe 5 years, I think. She had been convicted of first-degree premeditated murder when she was 16 years old, and she was tried as an adult and found guilty. And in Tennessee, if you're found guilty of first-degree murder, the least sentence you're going to get is 51 years. That's our life sentence. And so that's what she got. She was tried as an adult at 16 years old. She was found guilty, so she got the automatic 51-year sentence. So she's not eligible for parole until she was 67 years old. Now, when I had her in class, I was really blown away by how competent and capable she is. Anybody who knows Centoya is going to be impressed by how smart she is, how articulate she is, how well-read she is, how funny she is. She's sarcastic and opinionated, and she's not shy about telling you what she thinks about things. So she was a joy to have in class. This was her first college class. She was super excited to be in college. She was super excited to be learning about criminal law. And so she was spunky, and I didn't know a ton about her. You know, I got to know her as we spent time in class together, you know. But really, I liked her a lot. She was a great student, one of my best students, and we got to be friends. I learned more of her story kind of as we went on. I learned that she had been born to a mother who was addicted to drugs and alcohol, had abused alcohol throughout the pregnancy. So Centoya was born with fetal alcohol syndrome, which really messes with your ability to think rationally and to appreciate the consequences and impulse control. It just causes a whole lot of problems. Her mother abandoned her when she was young, and so she kind of bounced around looking for somebody to care for her. The person who did care for her, I think, did the best she could, but Centoya ran away when she was 16 and started living on the streets of Nashville. And before long, she took up with a pimp who essentially trafficked her for sex. And so he would force her to go out and work as a prostitute and then bring money to pay for drugs and the cheap motel where they were staying. And so one night, this person, this trafficker, put Centoya out, and she got picked up by a man who was in his early 40s. She was 16. And he took her back to his house, and she got really apprehensive because this guy was showing off his gun collection, and he was bragging about his guns and what a good shot he was, what a good marksman he was. And she was on drugs, you know, and she had been abused. She had been raped several times for the 2 weeks prior to this event. And something just kind of snapped. You know, she just kind of decided that she was not going to be abused or raped again. And so while the man had his back turned to her, she got a gun out of her purse that her trafficker had given her and shot the man in the back of the head. And she immediately recognized what she had done, and she fled. And it was not long thereafter that she was arrested, and then she was transferred from juvenile court to adult court and convicted of first-degree murder. And so I heard all of that, you know, and I had already been experiencing a fair amount of tension. The more I got involved in prison work, the less comfortable I got as a prosecutor, because for a couple of reasons. Number one, I was learning more about the criminal justice system than I had ever known. Didn't learn this stuff in law school, but going out to the prisons and reading, you know, people were putting books in my hands that were very helpful for understanding problems in the criminal justice system. And so I started really kind of feeling like the system was broken, that it was racially biased, and that punishment, this obsession with punishment, I was becoming very uncomfortable with that. But more importantly than that were these relationships. I was meeting these people who, these were good people, you know, I mean, these were people that I would have felt okay having as my neighbor, you know, and these people cared about me, and I cared about them. And I just kind of thought, man, you know, how many cases have I worked on where, if I had the opportunity to get to know the person, maybe I wouldn't have felt comfortable saying, yeah, they need to spend 6 or 8 years in prison, you know, when all you know about them is that they robbed a store. That looks pretty bad. But if you start hearing about, well, what was going on in their life when they robbed the store, because none of this stuff happens in a vacuum. I started really thinking, man, I don't need to be doing this job. And I was rethinking the gospel. I was taking the Sermon on the Mount more seriously. I was taking things like, you know, whatever you do for the least of these, you do for me, and Jesus identifying himself with the prisoners. And I started thinking, man, if he's identifying himself with the prisoners, I'm making arguments against them. It's like I'm on the wrong side. And how can I maintain any credibility going into prisons week after week when Monday through Friday I'm arguing that prison is exactly what needs to happen for these people? And so Centoya, I don't know, she just kind of brought it all to a head, because I felt like, man, we've let this girl down. You know, this poor girl was abused and exploited and trafficked. And when she finally resorts to violence, and who wouldn't, because violence was the culture in which she had just lived pretty much her whole life. When she finally does resort to violence, at that point, the only thing we know to do is punish her and throw her away for 51 years. you know, and that could have been predicted, you know, if we had paid attention to her earlier, of course she's going to act out violently, you know, and I felt very frustrated with the system that I was a part of, and ultimately had to walk away from it.
Part of what I'm fascinated is that your eyes were opened to the injustice of the system and you had to walk away from it. Whereas I'm sure that there are plenty of others who have their eyes opened to the system and the system just calls them into it and they can't get out of it for one reason or another. The family situation, economic situation that they're in. What was it about you that you said, I just can't do this anymore?
Well, you know, I think probably as much as anything, it was probably that there were people that I admired that I started feeling kind of embarrassed to be around. People like Richard Good, the professor who started the program, and people like Howard Zier, who had a pretty strong influence on Richard, and reading something by Will Campbell, the Baptist minister and civil rights activist. I just thought, you know, these are people that I respect, and when I hear them speak or when I read their words, it resonates with me, and I think there's something true here that jives with what I understand the gospel to be. And I don't want them to think less of me because of my job. And I started thinking, well, you know, if I'm feeling bad in front of these people because of my job, then, you know, it might be time to walk away from it. You know, I didn't want to live with that tension where I felt like I was always apologizing for my day job. You know, so even, and that's a dream. It was a dream. I wanted to be a prosecutor as a career. And so I think I fought against it some because dreams die hard. But I think at the end of the day, I just thought, well, if this is what I'm being called to in order to not be a hypocrite, in order to maintain any level of personal integrity, I have to let it go. And so that's what ultimately had to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Betsy's got a comment here. The idea of transferring juveniles to adult court seems another form of scapegoating at a level that makes us blind to injustice towards children. Yet I recognize that there are kids who will not be able to live among us. What's the solution?
Well, you know, I want to take my cue from the experts, and I've learned a lot from folks over at the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth, which is headquartered in Washington, D.C., and the Children's Defense Fund. And these juvenile justice advocates, you know, they're pounding this drum saying that children are different from adults, that they are physiologically and psychologically different from adults because their brains have not finished forming, they're not yet who they're going to be, and they have dramatic potential to change and become much more than their dark past. Now, that's not to say that keeping some kids separate for a while for everyone's safety and well-being is not appropriate, because it may be, but punishment might not be appropriate. You know, just because you keep somebody separate doesn't mean you're doing it to make them suffer. You know, it might be that you're keeping them separate for everybody's safety, and so you can focus on their well-being and cultivating in them their potential to do good. And so I would say the solution is, you know, even if you're dealing with a very violent young person, that person's well-being should be at the top of your priority list. And right now, what's at the top of the priority list is punishing that person. So when you have a juvenile transfer hearing, it does not matter what other factors weigh in favor of charging that child as a child and keeping them in juvenile court. Doesn't matter. If it's a first-degree murder case, they're going to be tried as an adult, because we want people to suffer if they've committed first-degree murder. And I think that that's the first thing that needs to change, is that we need to get away from this punishment-driven system and focus instead on investing in people's healing and well-being.
Yeah. You said at Theology in Peace that we don't hope for punishment to roll down like mighty waters, but we hope for justice to roll down like mighty waters. What does that look like, this healing process that you talk about? Because so much of our culture thinks of justice as punitive, as punishment. And what is more of a healing justice look like, do you think?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think punishment, I think, is just intentionally inflicting suffering. And whether you do that by executing people or you know, corporal punishment or solitary confinement, you're purposefully inflicting suffering. And to say that justice is tantamount to purposefully inflicting suffering, I think just flies in the face of scripture, and I think it flies in the face of people like Martin Luther King, who articulate these compelling, inspiring visions of justice that have nothing to do with punishment and inflicting suffering. They have to do with well-being for individuals and for communities. And so I would say that an approach to justice that is based on healing or restoration or transformation is going to look altogether different from a system that's based strictly on punishment. I mean, we know how to punish people. We're doing that more than any other culture in human civilization. But to focus on healing would mean that the needs of the victim and the needs of the person who inflicted the harm are front and center. And we need to start. So in Santoya's case, you don't just look at the fact that she killed somebody and then say, okay, well, then what's the penalty? 51 years. Instead, you look at all of the things that went wrong in Santoya's life leading up to that point, and we say, okay, we've got somebody who suffered. I mean, this person was sacrificed, in a sense, while that she was still in the womb. She was sacrificed to her mother's alcoholism, and she was sacrificed at every phase along the way, you know, by her trafficker and by the system. We sacrificed her again to our spirit of vengeance. And so I think you would want to look at her and say, well, what do we do for a girl who suffers from fetal alcohol syndrome, who struggles with impulse control? What do we do with a runaway who has been sexually abused and exploited for you know, 2 years out of her 16-year-old life? We need to invest in her education the way that Lipscomb is trying to do. We need to invest in her emotional healing and surround her with relationships that are going to be trustworthy and nurturing. And when that happens, and it's kind of happened for Santoya by virtue of the Lipscomb program and some of the friendships that she's made there, all of a sudden you start to see dramatic change. So the Santoya that I know now, that I visit at the prison, she is not the same person that she was when she was 16. None of us are, but boy, she sure isn't. And if you told me she's coming up for parole next week, I would have no hesitation to go to her parole hearing and say, this lady needs to be turned loose. She can make it. She's not going to go out and reoffend. We need to put a support network around her. But I need that. You know, we all need that. It's when you remove that things start to fall apart, and she never had it. And so I would say that a justice system that seeks to heal and transform is going to be like a network of support, you know, working on that person's well-being and communal well-being, trying to make sure that fewer and fewer people are slipping through these cracks.
I love it. Yeah. We've got two comments over here. One, Sarah Goddard Adler asks, what is the purpose of prison? Is it A, reformation, B, punishment, and or C, separating from and protecting the general population? Our system is based on B, which is punishment, but should be A, reformation, and C, separating from the and protecting the general population. You've been talking about that a little bit, but do you have any reflection on Sarah's comment there?
Well, I think it's of course true. I think we could learn a lesson from other cultures. You know, the Scandinavian countries are closing their prisons because they don't have anybody to put in them. But they have them. You know, they have them, and they'll put people in them. But if they have somebody who kills another person, they're going to really invest in that person. for 10 years. They're going to pour that they may separate them, like Sarah was talking about, you know, for everybody's safety. They'll separate them for a time. But it's going to be as short a time as possible for them to invest in them and have some reasonable assurance that, okay, this person's good to go. We don't need to keep them locked up anymore. And so the difference in like Denmark or Norway and us is that for Denmark, a success story is where, you know, somebody commits a crime and you invest in them and you turn them loose as fast as you can so that they can get back out there and not hurt anybody else and be a productive citizen. For us, success is burying somebody for as long as possible, no matter. And see, it doesn't matter what Centoya does. It doesn't matter what Centoya has done for the past 5 years or what happens 10 years from now or 20 years from now. You know, she could, there's nothing she could do. It's 51 years. And we claim that that's a success. We claim that's justice. It's far from it. Far from it.
Yeah. Suzanne asks, how can the law be reformed? It seems that legal systems are not designed for so-called objectivity. Yet you seem to be arguing for subjective evaluations of each individual. I mean, they are designed for objectivity, right?
Well, I mean, we say that we want them to be objective. You know, we say that we want to keep it, and that's why we have a jury, you know, 12 disinterested people, and a judge who is impartial. So we claim to be objective. But I think that our practice betrays that. I think that if you look at giving a 16-year-old child a 51-year sentence, you know, I don't think that I have to read too much into that to say, well, that's a product of vengeance. That is a matter of collective institutionalized vengeance. And we need to call it what it is. You know, we just need to say, yes, this is a system based on vengeance. Not personal, because the victim can't do it. If the victim goes out and kills that person in revenge, well, that's a crime in and of itself. But if the state of Tennessee does it, then we call that justice. Well, I don't see a huge difference.
Yeah. Wow. Sarah says, I think the first thing that must change is the culture of anger and fear. Our prison system and its legal forms reflect our culture.
I don't know what has created this culture of anger and fear that we're living in. It's scary, you know, and you know, for all the people who are up in arms about the success of Donald Trump, it seems to me that, you know, he is just the manifestation of our collective anger and fear. And I don't know that we can fix a culture of anger and fear that's as out of control as ours seem to be, where people are suspicious of refugees and suspicious of people based on their religion or the color of their skin. However, I think the church has got to have a different response, because, you know, we've got the most frequent command throughout Scripture is to not be afraid. And you've got 1 John that says that the opposite of fear is not courage, but it's love. And so I think we need to be training ourselves in love, because John says that perfect love casts out fear. And so whether you're afraid of prisoners or afraid of Muslims or afraid that you know, somebody from the LGBT community might use your bathroom, I think that what we need to do is really work hard to cultivate love. And the only way I know to do that is to work on relationships. You're probably not going to stop being afraid of prisoners until you go out there and meet a few of them. And so I would encourage people to not give in to that fear, because fear and anger really cause people to slip into some dangerous stereotypes. But go out there and try to meet some of these folks who are serving these sentences, because I sure experienced a change in the way that I thought about them once I got to know them.
Bringing up Donald Trump brings up racism for me. Seems like everything Donald Trump is saying these days has a racist undertone to it. And in a sense, I think that Trump, as you say, is the ultimate manifestation of these things. And in a sense, is holding up a mirror to us and the racism that infects so much of our country. And you had mentioned earlier a little bit about the racism that is part of the injustice of the prison industrial complex. Can you talk about the racism that's underlying this?
Well, sure. You know, on a very practical level, you know, statistically, we know that Black people are more likely to be arrested for the same crime. They're more likely to be formally charged. They're more likely to be found guilty. And once found guilty, they're more likely to be sentenced to terms of incarceration and longer terms of incarceration. Now, that in and of itself does not mean that the system is racist, right? Because somebody could argue, well, what if they're just committing more crime? But you can look at other factors. You can look at the fact that up until very recently, the federal sentencing guidelines punished possession of crack cocaine, which is thought of as kind of an inner city type low-income drug. They punished crack cocaine 100 times more severely than they did powder cocaine, which is thought of as more of a, you know, middle-class type party drug. So you would have to have 100 times more powder cocaine to get the same sentence that you would for crack cocaine. And they're the same substance. And when they revised that law a couple of years ago, they tried, the people who were wanting the reform wanted it to be a one-to-one, you know, the same sentence, no more disparity, but all they could get it down to is 20-to-1. And so even after all of this tough on crime rhetoric has started to kind of go away and we started seeing people like Michelle Alexander take us to task over some of the inherent racism in some of these policies, you still can't eliminate it. It's still a 20-to-1 disparity. And then you add to that the fact that so much of the crime that we're punishing so harshly is street level crime, while much more harmful conduct that's committed by folks kind of at the top, whether you're talking about environmental harm or OSHA violations or medical malpractice or white collar crime, way more costly in terms of dollars and harm to people. Very seldom does that result in serious prison time, because that's done by white people, you know? So I think we have to be honest. I think we can educate ourselves by reading a couple of books that will all of a sudden just make us kind of wake up to what has been going on right under our noses.
Yeah. Betsy says, if we have a violent God, we see punishment as necessary. Healing doesn't enter the computation. Our prison system reflects an unspoken theology, a theology of violence, I guess. Does that make sense to you? And how has this experience changed your theology, or has it?
Well, I started out my life, I think the way a lot of people do, feeling like I had different compartments for my life. You know, so I had my career as a prosecutor, but also wanted to be a good Christian. But that was mostly about, you know, going to church and being a good citizen. And part of this prison experience kind of demolished those compartments. And I started seeing that you can't talk about forgiveness and redemption on Sunday at church and then go be an agent of retribution and vengeance Monday through Friday. You know, you can't claim mercy for yourself, but then deny it for everybody else. And so, yeah, I mean, I think my theology has changed a great deal. And I would say that all these really important questions are fundamentally theological. And I think you have to pause and ask yourself, well, why is it that, you know, 75% of death penalty cases are coming out of Bible Belt states? You know, what is it, you know, because down here in Tennessee and Alabama or Mississippi or wherever, you can't throw a rock without hitting a church building. Everybody goes to church. All your politicians have to be good conservative Christians. What is it about that theology that makes people so dead set on punishment? And I grew up, and it was in my family. You know, this idea I remember when I read Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God by Jonathan Edwards. I finished reading it and I thought, well, yeah, that about sums it up. That's pretty much where we are. Thank goodness for Jesus, or else God would just dangle me over hellfire. And I kind of thought that was the way that it was, you know, that being a Christian is essentially believing a certain thing about God or Jesus or baptism or whatever. And because of that belief, I have now opted out of the general everybody goes to hell plan because we're all sinful, you know. And so that colors everything. You know, if God can't forgive apart from the death penalty, well, why would we be any different? And so I think even for people who don't give a rip about criminal justice or prison issues, that it's terribly important from our pulpits and in our Sunday school classes to confront this bad theology that says that God can't forgive until he killed somebody. And I think that's going to, our theologians have their hands full trying to deconstruct that narrative and prop up something new and more life-giving in its place.
What has this conversion experience, this transformation, Dietrich Bonhoeffer talks about the cost of discipleship. And hearing you talk about how you grew up in this culture and this is all around you and you have this radical experience that transforms your theology, your worldview, I'm sure that this has come at some kind of a cost to you personally.
Well, I mean, I don't really regard it that way. It was a difficult period, you know, where I felt very hypocritical and stupid for having been a Christian for 25, 26, 27 years, or by that time, probably almost 30 years, and feeling like I had gotten it so wrong. So it was humiliating for sure, but there's sure nothing about it that I really regret. You know, I mean, it's kind of like I had, and this, I think we're taught to do this, you know, to kind of set your mind on things and figure out what you want to do and what you want to be and go make it happen, you know. And so I had done that, and I felt like I had kind of chosen my path, and I grabbed the bull by the horns, and I went to law school, and I made it happen. And I think that I saw that most of that was an outworking of my pride and kind of a false sense of wanting to be important. And I had that taken away from me, but that's a good thing, you know. I mean, I feel like that was a lesson that I needed to learn because that was not the path I needed to be on. And so, you know, I take it as a grace that the path that I had chosen for myself, which turns out to be dead wrong, that this thing came along and knocked me off of it, and it kind of knocked me into a current that I did not choose for myself and that I don't know where it's going, and the best I can do is try to stay in the current and keep my eyes open and not miss anything so that when something like the Theology and Peace Conference comes along, I'm like, oh, fantastic, an opportunity to meet new people who are interested in taking these advanced ideas and applying them to justice issues and peacemaking. So that's been very exciting, and so I'm very grateful for what I've been through. And if it can help other people take the plight of prisoners a little more seriously and listen to these voices who are all too often silenced. I mean, these people are at best pushed to the side. At worst, they are just outright, you know, oppressed and abused. If something about this can make people a little more likely to listen and to maybe question, then, I mean, that's pure grace.
Yeah. Russ asks a question that's very much in the news, particularly because of the Stanford rape case. He asks, what is your experience with sex offenders? Are they, as often claimed, incapable of being reformed?
I don't think that anybody is incapable of being reformed. During the 90s, we heard the Clintons talking about these super predators, and that these were child offenders who were less than human, and they had to be dealt with harshly because they were incapable of being reformed. And the whole idea of a super predator, that was just a myth. You know, that wasn't real. It was a myth that was exploited by politicians and the media to make people afraid and to justify the draconian sentencing measures that were being put into effect. Now, you know, sex offenders, I know sex offenders, you know, I mean, I'm friends with some sex offenders. And I don't think you ever want to write off a whole group of people as being incapable of reformation. I think justice, the real kind of justice, you know, communal and individual well-being, and I think that requires different things for different people. You know, a sex offender is going to need different help than somebody who breaks into a pawn shop and steals stuff to support a drug habit. And they're going to need something different from a woman who kills her abuser, you know? So they're going to have their own sets of needs. But like I say, I mean, I've got friends who are sex offenders, and they're good folks who have experienced a lot of remorse and repentance. I would be unwilling to scapegoat sex offenders just like I wouldn't anybody else.
Awesome. Thank you for that. You had mentioned that we need to start listening better to prisoners. And I'm wondering how we can do that. Not all of us at Theology in Peace, you'd mentioned, not all of us are called to go to prison, but this is an important, especially if this is where one of the places where you meet Jesus, where we meet God in these relationships. What might be some of the ways that that we can listen?
Well, I think it's important for us to visit people who are incarcerated. I think it's important for us to, if we can't do that, to try to establish some sort of a pen pal relationship with somebody who's incarcerated, and those are not hard to find. There's a book that I talked about at the conference called And the Criminals With Him, and it's on Amazon. It was edited by Richard Good. And it's got the kind of autobiographical account of several people who are incarcerated. There's a blog called Prodigal Sons. It's probably prodigalsons.blogspot.com. And that was put together by a group of guys that I taught a couple of years ago, telling their stories. But I think that the more that we can listen to not just prisoners' voices, but anybody who finds themselves kind of marginalized, I think that that's what the ministry of Jesus was about, is you know, turning down the volume on the people who are always at the microphone and going to hear what people say out on the fringes of society. And so it may be, and I've got a group of friends who does this exercise every Good Friday. They go out and they do the Stations of the Cross on the streets of Nashville. And they just try to go places where they feel like the Lord is being betrayed and condemned even today. And so they'll hit a certain spot and they'll open their Bibles and they'll read a passage. And reading scripture outside of your normal church setting or devotional setting, you can kind of undomesticate it just a little bit. And so that's a way, I think, to listen for alternative voices, is to just go read scripture somewhere different or with people who are different. Because, I mean, there's stuff in there. I have read passages of scripture that I've read 20 times before, but you read it in a prison and it's like, oh my goodness, I never saw that before.
Yeah, that's so powerful. Preston, thank you for being on the show and sharing your story. It's so inspirational and wonderful. We're nearing the end of our hour. We were going to talk about Star Wars a little bit, but we're at the end of our time. So maybe we'll have to save that for another Ravencast.
I would love that.
Awesome. Let's plan to do that. If people want to keep up with you, how can they do that?
Well, I'm on Facebook, and so I'd be glad to connect on Facebook or Twitter. I'm probably on Facebook more than Twitter. I hadn't gotten used to the 140 characters. But my email address is just my name. It's preston.ship@gmail.com. And so if anybody would be interested in just an ongoing conversation, I would love to just talk to folks. So preston.ship@gmail. Or if they can get in touch with you, you know, you've got all my information. So
excellent.
But thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to chat. I really appreciate all that you and the Raven Foundation. I've been reading about the Raven Foundation, really pleased with all you're doing.
Well, you've added so much to our understanding of the criminal justice system, the lack of justice in the system. And your story is just, as I say, so inspirational and helps me to be a better Christian and just a better human being. So I'm just really grateful for you. So thank you for everything that you do. And thank you,
thank
everybody,
you
for joining us for this chat. Thank you for your comments and your questions. And keep up with the Raven Foundation on Facebook for future Raven casts.